All right, welcome back to the Indie Vets Happy Hour. I am your host, Dr. Andrew Heller, DVM, and I'm here with my co-host, Marissa Brunetti,
VMD. We're drinking coffee.
I know, it's a little early to be drinking beer on a Wednesday.
All right, well, I'm excited about today because I also get to tell everyone that you are a new vet influencer.
Oh gosh, don't call me that.
No.
It's weird.
It's actually great. Dr. Andrew Heller, if you don't know already, is now on Instagram and TikTok as a good-looking male veterinarian. So everyone follow him, dr.andrew.heller on Instagram. And what is your TikTok handle?
andrew.heller.dvm.
Awesome. All right. Well, everyone, if you subscribe to this podcast, you're definitely going to want to follow Andrew on Instagram and TikTok. He's doing, just like we do with this pod, short vet med tips because we don't have any time and we don't want to delve into the materials and methods of JAVMA. So thank you, Andrew, for that. What are we talking about today?
Today, we're continuing our Optho series with our very own Dr. Casey Robinson, our very own specialist.
Not specialist.
Our specialist, non-specialist.
With a significant interest in ophthalmology.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he makes it very interesting.
It's very eye-opening.
So today, I think, is probably one of the most dense topics we're going to cover in all of these episodes. It's uveitis, actually. So inflammation of the uvea in the dog and the cat.
Awesome. And if you guys missed it, you could check out our previous episodes with Dr. Robinson, where we talked about glaucoma. That was episode 33. We talked about KCS in episode 34. We did a whole thing on cats and their eyes in episode 35. And we touched on corneas in episode 36. So let's continue on with uveitis.
I can't wait.
I can. Uveitis is a very frustrating disease to me because first, it's really hard for me to like even picture the uvea. So maybe tell us more about like what the uvea really is.
Yeah. So the uvea is kind of broken into anterior and posterior segments. It's composed of three different structures. It's going to be the iris, the ciliary body, and the choroid, with anterior being the iris and the ciliary body and the choroid being posterior.
And which ones can you see?
I mean, the most readily evident structures that will appear abnormal to just on ocular exam is going to be the iris.
Yeah. Awesome. And so what does the uvea actually do in the eye?
So it plays a really, really pivotal role in maintaining the blood ocular barrier. So we'll see artifacts of that breakdown of that barrier in portions of our clinical exam, with the most notable being something we'll talk about pretty heavily, which is something I always, especially on like our clinical channel, when doctors are asking about certain eye diseases, my question is always, is there any aqueous flare? And that's going to be an inherent part of that breakdown of that blood ocular barrier. Overall, though, it's composed of the blood retinal barrier and the blood aqueous barrier.
Awesome. And so how do we know if we can only really see the iris? You know, what does this present like in dogs and cats?
So you're going to see quite a few things. So the one notable thing is it's quite painful. So you're going to see traditional signs of ocular discomfort. They'll be photophobic, so very sensitive to light. They'll be pretty squinty, so blepharospastic. I see a lot of these dogs come in with more systemic signs of pain, anorexia, depression, which I hate the term ADR. But I've had quite a few ADR cases on my schedule, which end up being uveitis.
Yep.
Harping on that aqueous flare, you get that breakdown of the blood aqueous barrier. Those vessels become permeable, and you get a leakage of protein and different types of debris into the aqueous humor. And that's going to kind of appear like headlights through fog when you're driving through fog, when you look into that anterior chamber.
Yeah, what's the best way to see that, and like, what's the best light to use? Because sometimes I go to clinics and like their ophthalmoscope is, the light isn't bright, and I'm like, what am I even looking at?
Right. So getting the most focal point of light that you can possibly get. So the smallest light source.
Like the aperture.
The aperture, really, thank you. And then look at the anterior chamber from about a 90 degree angle. And you should see your light hit the cornea, and you should see your light hit the iris in the normal eye. If you see any bridge between those two spots, that's going to be suggestive of an aqueous flare.
Cool.
You can also see accumulation of some of this debris on the endothelial surface. So that would be a choroidic precipitate. It just looks like a big glob, and usually they settle kind of ventrally. So you can see those, and those can be inherent in certain disease processes.
Are you going to see this in both eyes, or is this a unilateral thing?
It really depends on the underlying cause. I'd say a lot of times when I see uveitis, it's going to be more so an ocular manifestation of systemic disease. So I will see it as a bilateral type of a condition, but unilateral or bilateral. If you have like a traumatic uveitis, which you're probably not going to get a choroidic precipitate though, would be more of a unilateral type of uveitis. You can get hypopyon, kind of pus in the interior chamber, hyphema, blood in the interior chamber, really, really almost glaucoma-esque episcleral vascular injection, an edematous cornea. One thing that's a kind of a hallmark is the meiosis. So you're going to get a pretty small pupil, edema of the iris, and a spasm of the sphincter muscle of the iris is going to be kind of what's driving that meiosis.
Is the pupil always small?
Definitely not always. Sometimes you can see a very subtle anisocoria.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
One problem is not a lot of general practices have really effective mydriatics. I love to have phenylephrine when I have a Horner's case or something like that, but just not a commonly carried eye drop. It's just not used often. One inherent thing that you'll get with your diagnostic test is a low intraocular pressure. Now that's going to come from a inflamed and impaired ciliary body and intraocular prostaglandin formation, which will increase that uveoscleral outflow, which we talked about in the glaucoma episode.
Yeah. How low would you see it?
I would say anything under 10. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've seen it too low to read.
Mm. Wow.
I've seen it that bad. The opposite of a glaucoma eyeball, just like smushy. Almost you can see it like indent too much when you do your eplanation tonometry.
What else can you see?
You can see synechiation. So kind of a sticky iris, and it can go either anterior or posterior. So either adhere to the lens capsule or adhere to the corneal endothelium. Long term, you can get these kind of dyschoric pupils, so just an abnormal pupil shape, just because it's stuck in places it shouldn't be stuck. You can get subtle variations in pigmentation to the iris. That's going to be kind of a classic or a hallmark sign in golden retriever uveitis. Mm-hmm. Some of the more subtle things that are going to be very difficult to pick up is going to be like a vitreal haze and edema or exudate detachment of the retina.
Yeah, that's harder. Are you putting mydriatics in this eye?
If I have it,
yeah,
I will. If the pressure is not sky high, if we're in like a secondary glaucoma, because I want to see what that pupil does.
Right.
But honestly, I probably haven't had that at the ready more than a handful of times since I was in full-time opto.
Yeah. So it's actually funny that you said glaucoma, because I was going to be like, how can uveitis lead to glaucoma? But obviously I see, you know, there's tons of consequences of uveitis that aren't just pain. So what are some of those?
The synechiation is huge. A lot of us have heard of iris bombae. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get that 360-degree synechiation. It can be anterior or posterior. I'd say personally, I see most commonly posterior. Another consequence that people don't think about often is cataract formation. Mm. The aqueous becomes altered and interferes with nutrition to the lens. Mm-hmm. One thing, whenever you have a cataract and active inflammation of the uvea or uveitis, always asking, what was there first? Mm. Was the eye red and then the cataract showed up? Or was the cataract there and then the eye became red? Mm. That will be inherently important down the road when we talk about different types of uveitis.
That's a good tip.
And if they don't know, they don't know.
I think you're going to get to the point that cataracts can trigger uveitis, right?
Certainly.
If they leak.
Yeah.
So if you see an immature cataract, it's less likely.
Considerably less likely. You need that resorbing lens or liberation of those lens proteins to leak through the lens capsule and initiate that immune response in the eye. So a lens-induced uveitis, which is going to be a form of an immune-mediated uveitis. Hmm. Other than the cataract, glaucoma. I mean, we talked about secondary glaucoma kind of ad nauseum on the first episode that we did. But you get that impaired aqueous outflow. You know, the inflammatory cells that have leaked from those vessels will block that angle. You can get that synechia, so you're not getting that normal flow from the posterior chamber through the pupil out the iridocorneal angle. And again, just that overall occlusion of the pupil. You can see retinal detachment. We kind of talked about that as the clinical signs. Atrophy of the ciliary body and iris just from the chronic inflammation. Or a pre-iridial fibrovascular membrane. That's going to be really, really, really difficult to see without a slit lamp. But it's just a vascular ingrowth, and it can kind of cover and mat over the iridocorneal angle, impairing outflow.
Hmm. So question, how long does the animal have to have uveitis for these types of things to happen? Can it happen pretty quickly? Is it something that's like days, weeks?
Hard question. I don't know if I have a great answer for that. I think it's going to certainly be more on the side of a more chronic type of uveitis, but I don't have a great answer as to a time frame of how long this has to be present to see some of these consequences. I would say the sooner we can act, the better.
And I think it is tough because you're right. I do see a lot of iris atrophy and then, you know, forgetting that maybe uveitis was never seen. And so, like, is there a way that pet parents, you know, can, if it's not obvious, like, what are some things maybe that they would notice possibly?
I think most of my uveitis cases will come in for two things, a red eye and a squinty eye.
Yep. And everyone thinks, like, the cat scratched the dog's eye, right?
Always. Always.
Always.
It's sometimes the cat, but it's rarely the cat.
Right.
Yeah, I've had a few people come in for, she seems sensitive to light. Mm-hmm. The ones that are really, really, really on it will notice the differences in pupil size. But by the time you get to that, they've probably already noticed the red eye, the photophobia,
yeah,
the blepharospasm.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So diagnosing this, how do we do that?
So diagnosis, we check all of our boxes. As with a lot of the other things we've discussed, your ophthalmic exam is huge. And a lot of times you probably have your answer before you even look to your diagnostics. But things we do kind of from a classification standpoint, you want to know which tissues are affected. Is it an anterior uveitis? Is it a posterior uveitis? Or is it a panuveitis, the entire uvea? Mm. We can go into presumed kind of histopathologic nature. It can be very, very difficult. You know, there's suppurative, non-suppurative, granulomatous, non-granulomatous, but that's not going to have a huge bearing on what we do.
If you guys can't see me, but I'm just shaking my head, no.
One thing that always is important is location of cause. Is this a reflex uveitis from corneal disease, or is this endogenous, something going on inside the eye? And then ultimately, we always want to determine etiology. And this is one of those things where the list of things that can cause uveitis is going to span a few pages of a textbook, right? If you look at all these species. So etiologic diagnosis is going to be difficult but possible to reach, but that's going to be part of your classification.
But I think to remind people before we even delve into some of the like most common ones is, if you diagnose uveitis or think that you have uveitis, this is more, you should think about doing more diagnostics than just things that affect the eye, correct?
You're doing the gamut.
You're right.
Serum chemistry, complete blood count, urinalysis, thoracic radiographs.
4DX.
4DX, always. Looking at infectious disease testing, toxoplasmosis titers, blasto urine antigen.
Yeah.
It's all selection.
Right.
In the case, the history. I'd say the most beneficial diagnostic test that we can run is going to be looking for that low IOP or hypotony. Most commonly, unless it's an exogenous cause, you're not going to see any fluorescein retention. And I guess, if anything, on the Schirmer-Tear test, you can see increased tearing as a consequence of the pain.
Right. All right. So I know you just briefly touched on them, but what are some of the most common causes?
So the most common causes were going to be, you know, infectious agents. So you can see, I mean, even algae can cause it. Bacterial agents, protozoal. So we'll all probably think of toxo as our top. Parasitic, heartworm is known to cause it. I've actually seen an actual heartworm swimming around in the anterior chamber of an English setter.
Cool.
In Michigan?
In Michigan. It was a rescue dog. And of all the videos that I've lost in my time, I regret losing this video. It was super cool. And then viral. There's multiple viral causes. Immune mediated. So we touched on the lens-induced uveitis. You can see phacoclastic uveitis, which is somewhat similar to the lens-induced. Uveodermatologic syndrome and some of your Japanese breeds like the Akita. Neoplastic or paraneoplastic causes. Metabolic, and I think the most common ones I'm going to see is diabetes mellitus, looking at that lens-induced uveitis. Systemic hypertension, sometimes you get that hyphema. Hyperlipidemia, and certain types of coagulopathies. Traumatic uveitis, I believe this is something more of an entity in like the like a horse, but definitely a dog can get pinged with a soccer ball or what have you and get a traumatic uveitis. Toxic. Pilocarpine, which probably most of us don't see, but we talked about using pilocarpine in treatment of certain types of KCS or a neurogenic KCS.
Yep.
Latanoprost. When you overuse latanoprost, you can, because it is a prostaglandin analog. The reflex uveitis that we talked about back when we talked about corneas. Idiopathic, which is a diagnosis of exclusion. Those would be probably the most common ones that I'll see.
Awesome.
All right, Casey, I got a question. How often is the etiology actually diagnosed?
It really, really depends on the ability of the owner to do the workup, because this is one of those extensive workups. Kind of like working up an IMHA, looking for that ultimate cause. I put it in the same category because so many different things can cause it. For me, I probably bat below 50%. Does my treatment change? Not always. Do I sometimes cast a very wide net and put my uveitis cat on clindamycin because I can't run toxotitres? I mean, absolutely. But I think it really depends.
Yeah.
Frequently, I diagnose an idiopathic uveitis. And in my experience, it's usually due to limitations with the workup. And looking back to my opto days, yeah, probably north of 50%, we found an etiology.
That's good to know.
All right. Treatment.
Treatment. Trying to make that etiologic diagnosis. Again, idiopathic is a diagnosis of exclusion. So as I noted previously, serum chemistry, CBC, urinalysis, 3-view thoracic rads. I really harp on that. It's something people frequently forget, thinking about those neoplastic causes. Abdominal ultrasound be another thing. In dogs, especially with a relevant travel history, a blastourine antigen. And then in cats, I will most of the time be recommending a toxotitre. So trying to make that. Obviously, that gives us somewhat of an answer, doesn't direct treatment. So how do we direct treatment? The number one thing is controlling that inflammation. I'd say if I have an intact corneal surface, so no fluorescein retention, I'm reaching for corticosteroids, always keeping in mind that if it is a infectious cause, I could be making it worse, but I feel like for me, they work better in controlling the inflammation. You can go topical, you can go systemic, you can go subconjunctival if you are so bold, like a triamcinolone.
No.
Have you done that?
I did it in my internship like twice, and it was because they weren't able to put eye drops in. And I don't think those cases went well because there were so many other eye drops the dogs needed.
Yeah, yeah.
We should start putting in those things that we put for horses. What are those called?
Lavage.
The lavage, yeah.
The subpalpebral lavage.
Yeah, I love that.
They're super cool.
Makes it so easy.
It really does. Again, always considering, at least warning the owner before using a steroid. If this is an infectious cause, I could be making things worse. I'll usually reach for a dexamethasone or 0.1% dexamethasone or a 1% prednisone. I personally am probably partial to prednisone. And for corticosteroids, I usually reach for an anti-inflammatory dose. If I'm really nervous about an infectious cause, I'm probably going to go more towards an NSAID. Again, topical or oral. The two topical ones that I'll use is diclofenac and flurbiprofen. And then you choose on your oral. I don't think there's any studies that show one oral NSAID is better than another for uveitis.
And you're using both, oral and ocular.
Most of the time, yes.
Perfect.
Trying to hit the eye from the front and the back.
That sounds so bad.
That's definitely going in the clip.
That's definitely going
trying to hit the eye anteriorly and posteriorly. I don't know if that's better.
Still the same.
So with corticosteroids and NSAIDs, you can use systemic corticosteroids with topical NSAIDs.
I have, yes.
I mean, but like what would be, I guess, if there's an ulcer, is that what you're thinking? If there's a corneal ulcer? You wouldn't even use NSAIDs. Why would you use? Well, I don't know.
You're saying not to use both at the same time, right? You're not saying use topical corticosteroids and topical NSAIDs. You're saying one or the other.
I've honestly, in desperation, I've reached for both.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The systemic absorption of the two topicals is not going to be enough to cause those systemic sequelae. So when I'm desperate, I do. I'll have both.
Good to know.
But again, that's out of desperation. So again, as another last-ditch effort, you can reach for a cyclosporin or some more potent immunosuppressive like azathioprine, mycophenolate. I can't say I've ever had to do that, but I know that it is documented. We talked about a lot of sequelae or the consequences of uveitis, so a lot of the treatment is directed at preventing those. So mydriatics are huge. So I usually will kind of be looking at a 1% atropine 1 to 3 times a day. Mm. You want to reduce the synechia formation, the possibility of the iris bombae, and that can paralyze that ciliary muscle and will help with ocular pain.
So I know a lot of general practitioners always wonder, you know, they know how to start treating this, but how long do you treat this for? Is it just until it resolves? Is it until you resolve the underlying etiology? How long of treatment?
This is a great question,
Andrew. That was a good question.
I remember just, you know, being a new vet and knowing how to treat things, but not knowing how long to treat them for. So I always want to be able to answer those questions for people.
Totally. I will usually treat past the resolution of clinical signs and slowly taper down on my drugs.
And how often are you rechecking this?
If I have appreciable amount of aqueous flare, I will be rechecking this in 1 week. And then I'll kind of tailor my next rechecks as to how they're doing. I've had them where I have them cruising on like a once a day prednisone for 2 to 3 weeks, and then I recheck them. It really depends on how they're doing at their subsequent rechecks to see how often I'll recheck them. But I always, always, always will treat well beyond the resolution of clinical signs, especially in a bad uveitis.
Awesome.
Anti-glaucoma drugs. So we talked about why the IOP is low in cases of uveitis. If you have a normal IOP or it is elevated in the face of active inflammation, we should be concerned about a secondary glaucoma. Very similar to tearing in corneal ulceration. If you have a low Schirmer tear test in the face of a corneal ulcer, you should be looking at a possible underlying dry eye. Mm. Exact same thing here. If you have a normal or high IOP in the face of active inflammation, I'm going to be worried and I'm probably going to start that dog on a topical beta blocker like atenolol or a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor like a drizolamide. Unless you're desperate, try to avoid reaching for latanoprost.
Right.
You're introducing more prostaglandin into the eye. You're exacerbating inflammation.
We always forget. We're like, oh, the IOP is normal. But like, what if it's like 16, but the eye is really inflamed? You're like,
Yeah, I'm getting nervous. In a really, really inflamed eye, you should be well under 10.
Yeah. And like, is there any serious harm to putting in that, say, dorzolamide if you're not sure?
I think you would regret not putting the dog on dorzolamide more than you would regret putting the dog on dorzolamide.
Perfect.
Because, I mean, uveitis, granted there are long-term consequences to vision, but we cover the relatively short-term consequences to vision with glaucoma.
Right.
So if you control the inflammation, but the dog's blind because it had an untreated secondary glaucoma for a few days, that's a bummer.
Yeah.
So I always say, I'm going to regret not putting the dog on the medication more than I'm going to regret putting them on it.
Perfect.
Risk reward.
There you go.
That's how Andrew lives his life.
Every day.
And then pain relief. So we talked about the benefits to topical atropine and then your oral medications.
Awesome. All right. Well, I think we talked about this, but I do think it's important to talk about specific forms of uveitis. You mentioned some of them, but one you didn't really jump into was the pigmentary uveitis in golden retrievers.
Right.
I'm also interested in dental disease.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about these specific forms of uveitis.
So we'll start with pigmentary uveitis. This is, again, in the golden retriever. Basically, pigment dispersion in the anterior chamber. You're going to see a darkened, thickened iris. You can see pigmentation on the lens capsule itself or the corneal endothelium, thought to be associated with uveal cysts, which you can see in other breeds other than the golden retriever. But all the studies are done in the golden retriever. And looking at the different types of cysts you see, that's for a different day. So it's thought to be associated with those uveal cysts versus being an immune-mediated type of a disease. It can be rather devastating. I've seen golden retrievers go blind from it, and that frequently does require long-term therapy. Yeah. A lot of the studies are done out of Purdue for golden retriever uveitis.
Interesting. So how can dental disease cause uveitis?
I mean, honestly, this isn't something that was really harped on much in my internship. So I can't say that I've ever seen uveitis that I've definitively said this is secondary to dental disease. But I know that severe gingival disease, periodontal disease, and probably the most marked and fixable is going to be a tooth root abscess.
Makes sense.
So it's just like local inflammation triggering it.
I think it's just like an ascending type of a inflammatory response.
I feel like I've seen a ton of dachshunds. You like dachshunds. So I've seen a ton of dachshunds with like iris atrophy like later in life. And I'm wondering if that is connected to tooth root abscesses now because they also have terrible dental disease if people don't. So I'm wondering, like, have you seen that?
I think it's hard to say because, again, especially without active inflammation, I might just attribute it to a normal age-related change to the iris.
Yeah.
Because if, say, there's a tooth root abscess, the inflammation isn't going to subside without treatment.
True.
But I think that's fair. But I mean, the dachshunds, my dog's teeth are horrendous 6 months out of a dental. So, like,
that's
definitely a breed that I think it's a reasonable consideration.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. Go on.
No, you're fine. Infectious causes. Again, we talked about the specific forms. I think in dogs, the most relevant are going to be blasto, histo, ehrlichiosis, and coccidiomycosis. In cats, the big three are going to be FIP, toxoplasmosis, and cryptococcosis.
Great.
So for vets working in the Ohio River Valley, they're going to see much more of this.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, certainly.
Tell us what the Ohio River Valley is.
You don't know about the Ohio River Valley, Marissa?
No, I do. I just always remember learning about it in school, and I'm just like, so what encompasses that Ohio River
Valley? I know. I just like saying Ohio River Valley because I hear blasto and histo. I'm like, Ohio River Valley. We don't see it much in Pennsylvania.
Mm-mm. We see it rarely in Michigan. I think I've seen a few cases, I think, in all my time of blasto, and even less causing uveitic disease.
Okay, hold on. I have a definition of what is considered the Ohio River Valley for everyone.
Oh, perfect.
Wow. Okay, it's big. You could roughly define this area with a line from Pond Creek at the Salt River to Cosmosdale, Valley Station, the west end of Louisville, downtown and south of River Road to the north end of the county.
So that sounds small if it's like part of a county. I thought it was like a bunch of states.
Me too. Well, when you look at the picture, it's really the Ohio River, which is like from the middle of Illinois as the most western point to actually up through the middle of Pennsylvania.
Wow.
As south as the northern tip of Georgia and as north as the northern tip of Ohio.
That's a region.
Yeah,
that's a big region. So, yeah.
Also, I think you mispronounced that per Carrie. She says it's not Louisville, it's Louisville.
Louisville. Louisville.
She does say that. Louisville.
Let's see, where did I leave off?
Cats. You're talking about cats, I think you mentioned.
The infectious causes in cats. So toxo, FIP, and cryptococcosis. Immune-mediated causes of uveitis are always something important, especially in, so you have an Akita coming in with panuveitis. Maybe it has some depigmentation in the mucocutaneous junctions. Be thinking something like a uveodermatologic syndrome. And then something that I think is underdiagnosed is lens-induced uveitis.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't just have to be like leakage from a cataract too. That can actually be the cat scratch. Cat claw goes in, penetrates the lens, the anterior lens capsule, and you get that leakage. A few other infectious causes, FIP is a big one, but feline leukemia, FIV, Bartonella, mm-hmm. that's something that when in doubt, you can always test for Bartonella. From a neoplasia standpoint, lymphosarcoma is a big one. Interestingly enough, in rabbits, and I've actually seen one case of this, you can get a really nasty phacoclastic uveitis secondary to encephalitozoon cuniculi.
It's a lot. Encephalitozoon cuniculi. A lot of syllables.
A lot of letters. I saw it one time in Georgia. We talked about those toxic types of uveitis and then the traumatic uveitis.
All right. So Casey, to summarize, what are the major pearls that you want the audience to take home from this lecture?
Always make sure you're looking in the anterior chamber for aqueous flare in the red eye. It's a really, really commonly missed portion of the ophthalmic exam that is going to drastically direct your treatment. Explain to the owner the workup for uveitis similar to what you would an IMHA, that this can represent a problem anywhere in the body, and that in order to get that answer, if there is one, like if there isn't exactly one in the case of idiopathic, but it's going to be a long journey, a diagnostic journey. Aggressive treatment is always going to be favored as opposed to more of a benign approach. Like, I don't think these dogs should be going home with just a top, like, Neopolydex. I don't think that's going to be enough for a severe uveitis.
Well, Casey, it's been awesome having you on for this Optho series. I certainly learned a lot. Marissa, how about you?
I hate uveitis, but I loved this podcast. Thank you, Casey Robinson, as always.
Yeah, it was great having you on. You're always welcome. We can talk about other topics as well. Hopefully the audience enjoyed it just as much as we did.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me. I've honestly had a blast.
Not a blast-o.
And yeah.
A blast.
I've had a blast-o. That was the nerdiest joke I've heard like in a while. It was good. I love it. But yeah, no, I would love to come back for non-eyeball related things. Super duper fun. And yeah, thank you guys so much.
Oh, thank you. All right. We hope you enjoyed this episode on the Indie Vets Happy Hour. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends, and if you like us, leave us a 5-star review and make sure to subscribe so you can be alerted whenever we have a new episode. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at clinical@indievets.com. Also, to learn more about us and how we're making vet med better, head to indievets.com. That's IndeVets.com. While you're there, be sure to head to our blog for the latest stories and tips from our doctors. And lastly, if you're interested in joining our amazing IndieVets team, please email Dr. Andrew Heller at andrew@indievets.com. See you next time. Cheers.
Cheers.
I'm a veterinarian, sure, but I'm way more than that. I am also a tango dancer, a struggling but determined pie maker, and a mom. With Indie Vets, I get to choose when and where I work. I create my own schedule and choose shifts at nearby animal hospitals that are right for me. Having that flexibility is exactly what I need to have plenty of time for all those other things that I am. Because I'm more than just a vet. Visit IndieVets.com to learn more and apply.